That's kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul and the night.
Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we're very excited to welcome to the podcast today Anusar Farooqui. Anusar is the writer of the Policy Tensor Substack, and he also has a Twitter presence at the same name, and he's also a military historian. And I've invited Anusar to talk about a couple of things: the issue of whether Iran is a great power, the recent piece I wrote for the Ideas Letter on power without ideology. The link will be in the show notes. And so we're very excited to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, guys. This is exciting.
Really, really appreciate it. So why don't we just start? Because on Twitter, you've been very critical of one of the first parts of the essay, which discussed what I call in the piece this new pyramidal multipolar order. And to make a long story short, I argue that the new order is going to not be a unipole like existed between, let's say, 1989 or so and, I don't know, 2016 or so. It's not going to be bipolar like the Cold War, but it is going to be a different type of world order, an order defined, at least according to my piece, by a multipolarity. But the multipolarity is, I think, going to be of a different character than the previous era that most people point to as evidence of multipolarity, which is really the concert of Europe that existed between the Congress of Vienna in 1815 and the outbreak of World War I in 1914, really defined by European powers. Instead, I argue that there will be a new pyramidal structure with the US and China at the top as two superpowers, below them India, Russia, and the EU as great powers, and then below them a series of middle powers occupying the base like the UK, Japan, Iran, and others. And so that's just my argument about the multipolar order, and we'll get into other parts, but Anusar, as you well know, Anusar took a exception to my not placing Iran among the great powers and right below the US and China. So I thought it would be good because I think this will allow us to talk theory, which is always fun. About, I could lay out the claim about why I don't think Iran is a great power. And then Anusar, you could lay out your claim, and then we could talk about where we disagree, if we do disagree, and what that might say about how we analyze international order. So maybe I should just quickly lay out my argument about why Iran is a great power, which is what Anusar believes and what Robert Pape, also for previous guests of the show, has been arguing, although Anusar and Pape argue from different perspectives. So let me start with the economy, even though I know Anusar does not believe that this is the most important thing, but I think it's worth mentioning that Iran has a GDP of about $300 billion, which is about the size of Greece and New Zealand. Even when you adjust GDP for purchasing power parity, its economy is about the size of Bangladesh and Pakistan. Its currency is in repeated free fall. Its majority of exports, it's not a mono economy. Majority of exports are petroleum related, even though it does actually, the fun thing I learned in researching for this episode, it does export most of the world's saffron. But let's just say, like, obviously those are not the economy, that's not the economy, the economic picture of any country that one would identify as a great power. But even let's put that to the side, because Anusar, perhaps rightly, we shall see, doesn't really think the economy is crucial in determining whether or not Iran is a great power. I personally don't agree, but let's just grant that for now. So this is fun because now we're actually getting to the realm of more theory, which is, what is a great power? Now, there are various arguments about what a great power is. This is obviously a hotly debated topic. Some people have even argued it's not useful at all because it is more a political claim than necessarily an analytical claim. I don't necessarily agree. I think it's worthwhile trying to identify powers according to type. So to my mind, and then Anusar, you could tell me if you do disagree with this, what makes a great power is that it has to have two capacities. First, the ability to seriously project power outside of its region, as well as the ability to shape, to some degree, the order of world politics. That could be in its region or it could be outside its region. I think it's been both over time. But I would argue, and this is perhaps where we disagree, is that just contributing to the military defeat of a larger country does not make a country a great power. If that was the criterion of great powerness, we could argue that Vietnam was a great power, that Afghanistan's a great power, that Algeria is a great power. And I don't think anyone serious would argue either of those things. So let's assume that military defeat isn't by dint of definition the criterion of great power. So let's turn to Iran. So I think the arguments in favor of Iran being a great power are, of course, that it supported the so-called Axis of Resistance for a lot of times. You look at the Axis of Resistance, Hezbollah has been severely weakened by Israel and the U.S. Assad in Syria fell. But the major success have, of course, been the Houthis. One could argue that the Houthis aren't Iran and obviously have a very different agenda from Iran vis-a-vis the Red Sea and Yemen. And I would even point to the fact that in early 2025, Iran asked the Houthis to quote-unquote cool tensions. I believe that is an exact quote in the Red Sea, and the Houthis just ignored them. So I think this suggests Iran has limited ability to shape the Houthis. But let's even bracket all of that, which to me is already a definition of why Iran is a great power. And let's talk about the crux of your argument, which is that Iran's ability to control the Strait of Hormuz is its basic indication, the basic indication that it is a great power. Basically, the claim as I read it is that because Iran can control the strait, it could thus shape international oil supplies. Therefore, it is ipso facto a great power. And was also able through drones to really harm the United States and its bases, which I think is actually crucial. And I think augurs something important for international politics, but let's bracket that also for a second. I think we're going to talk about this. Okay, so from that logic, that because Iran can control the strait, it is a great power, certain things follow. According to that, then Singapore, which controls the Strait of Malacca, which carries an enormous amount of global trade, and which has a very powerful and very advanced navy, is therefore a great power. You could also argue that Denmark, which could choke point the Danish Straits, is a great power. And you could even argue that the Houthis' ability to disrupt trade in the Red Sea makes them, as a non-state actor, a great power. We would probably all think that is absurd. The most obvious comparison to Iran, I think, is Saudi Arabia, which obviously controls a massive oil supply, which leads to the question, is Saudi Arabia a great power? Or even more directly, were the OPEC countries that disrupted world oil flows in the 70s a great power? I think most people would say, obviously not. And then we could even turn that on its head and say, China doesn't fully control the South China Sea. Does that mean that China isn't a great power? So this leads me to argue, at least, and I'd love to hear your response, that having control or not having control over critical supply chains does not necessarily lead a nation to have great power status, because great powers need to shape regional and world orders. What Iran is in effect doing, it is that is threatening and disrupting to a significant degree an order that was in effect created by an outside power, in this case, the United States. I would also take issue with your claim, Anusar, that you have made several times, that this transformation is permanent. To my mind, at least, this puts the cart before the horse. The Fifth Fleet is still in Bahrain, and Gulf countries are at this moment modernizing their militaries, particularly by building connections with China and India. And so just the ability to disrupt a critical regional node of trade does not equate to great power status, at least in my mind, especially because in this instance, the regional node's impact on the global economy is almost certainly going to be limited. This might take a decade, but I think it's going to happen because other routes, particularly overland routes, are going to be built, I think, after this, that will limit the impact of the closing of the strait. So Iran doesn't shape order. It doesn't project power. And to my mind, it's not a great power. To do this, Iran would have to just be more than just a disruptor of international trade. It would need to have things like a blue water navy, a conventional military that could actually be able to be deployed abroad, an ability to produce, for example, advanced fighter craft and not be dependent on China and Russia. It would have to be able to construct a regional order, which it has shown no ability to do. It would have to have some form of international institution-making capacity. It would have need to have the ability to invest abroad. And it would just have to have the ability to shape politics far beyond its region. Iran does none of these, and it has none of these. So I think the evidence is going to be much more difficult for you to suggest that Iran is a great power, given the realities that I pointed out. So there you go. And you can take it however you want.
Yeah, thank you for the wide-ranging Iran is not a great power spiel. But I think that's all over the place. Let me give you a more systematic way of thinking about this question. The three scholars that come to my mind when I think about this question of great powers and multipolarity and so on. One is about, first of all, how did we go from a unipolar world to whatever we are describing as the multipolar world? The obvious mechanical way in which you go from unipolarity to multipolarity is the rise of other great powers, which you count as the poles, and you count the number of these powers, and you say, this is the polarity of the system. It has increased, and that is what has happened in the transition from a unipolar world to a multipolar world. Okay. You have given a lot of criteria for why Iran should do this and do that to be considered a big power, a great power or not. But I don't think that that quite works that way. The issue is best discussed by Jack Levy in his History of the Great Power, Modern Great Power System, where he discusses what the issue is about this, some states being designated as great powers and others as not. So, you know, states like Austria and Prussia and so on, these states did not have power projection capabilities. They were regarded as great powers because if you left them out of the calculation, things could go badly wrong. Great power was the sort of state that had to be included if your calculations of the balance of power in Europe were supposed to be accurate, roughly. First order accuracy of your balance of power equations depends on the inclusion of all states in the system that have this great power.
Well, you're mathematizing. Could you explain? Like, that's a rather idiosyncratic definition of great power, and Levy is particularly influential. What do you mean by equations?
I'm talking about the actual response functions and behaviors of great powers and statesmen when they had to decide the question of Cilicia, who did they have to invite on to the table without which things could not work out. The fact that they had to invite Prussia on the Cilician question showed us that that Prussia was a great power. And this is how historians have included in their
Vietnam's a great power because Vietnam had to be involved in the discussions to end the war?
No. Vietnam was never included in questions of global importance. It was merely the United States lost the war against an insurgency and a government in a proxy war. It was not a conventional war with a...
France was included in negotiations to end World War II. Does that mean France was a great power at the end of World War II?
No, it could have been ignored and nothing much would have been lost. My point is that if you do...
Well, the colonial powers, I think this is rather idiosyncratic. Sorry, please, I'll let you...
You gave your spiel for a long time. Please let me build my argument. So one motivating sort of framework to understand the transition from unipolarity to multipolarity is Gilpin, the law of uneven growth. We need to understand which powers grew in power, which powers did not grow in power, relatively to others, to understand the new scheme of things, right? And so what is the evidence? What is the test for powers grew in power? Now, one of the things that I don't think that realists disagree at all about is the importance, even the primacy of military contests, military decisions and wars, specifically the evidence from high-intensity wars between the powers. And the evidence here is quite unambiguous. And let me tell you the technological evidence here. Andrew Kuprinevich theorized that this unipolar world that we're talking about in the early mid-90s is going to vanish, is going to transform into a multipolar world with the diffusion of mature precision strike regime. And what is going to happen here is that the American monopoly on precision strike, on remote strike, is going to go away, and other powers are going to become going to master this technology and therefore become really powerful states, denying what we've called a command of the global commons since Boson's great work, right? Command of the global commons is a unipolar world. If a state has command of the global commons, that's a unipolar world. When that state loses command of the global commons, it loses that command to states in different regions that can deny it military access to that region. And so if you think in this kind of systematic way about the transition from a unipolar world to a multipolar world, then you want to ask yourself, where is the unipole unable to project military power? One proof that we have, definite proof that we have, is that Iran is capable of and has kicked out U.S. forces from the Persian Gulf. By the way, your 5th Fleet headquarters in Bahrain is incorrect. The 5th Fleet headquarters is no longer going to be in Bahrain. Bahrain is not a viable military base.
Well, to be decided. I mean, I think you're also like projecting out quite a few things when this is by no means over. But continue. I don't accept that.
Okay, so this is a question of wagers, and I'm glad to disagree on predictions, right? Because one of us will be proven wrong, one of us will be proven right. The United States will not control essential wager of this argument of that Iran's great power is that it will be in military control, de facto military control of the Persian Gulf for the foreseeable future. If that does not turn out to be true, I would have been wrong. But
even then, that does not confer great power status. I mean, this might be, frankly, a difference between political science and history, whereas I think you're searching for basically a counterfactual, almost quantitative metric,
I'm thinking as a historian, as a process, as a historian of international systems, with a certain and how polarity about that has been. This happens to be a very IR. Focused, realist focus of thought over time. So it does sound like a lot of political science, but essentially the question goes down to Schroeder for me. But let's go back to Iranian power, right? The Pentagon informed Congress that China has 2,200 short-range and medium-range ballistic missiles capable of hitting our assets between Taiwan and Guam. This is a very, very important metric because it determines how vulnerable our bases are in Asia. Okay, 2,200. JINSA, the Israeli Research Institute, reported that Iran had fired 2,200 short-range and medium-range ballistic missiles. We note that this is only 30% of, no more than 30% of their arsenal, so that their actual arsenal is much larger. Now, it is possible that the Pentagon's report to Congress is wrong and that the Pentagon is completely wrong about its intelligence on the Chinese arsenal. But even then, you have to understand that the Pentagon is telling Congress in all seriousness.
No, but we agree. But dude, we agree.
China is a small portion of Iranian missiles.
Iran was able to shut down the strait. I mean, I'm not disagreeing. And it was able to show that the U.S. projects power.
I'm talking about the power that has produced that many missiles, right? It's an important fact about the world. This is a world in which precision strike and mature missile power is very, very important. In this world, Iran is really punching above its weight. Okay. Think about the problem of militarily contesting American power, right? The strategic task for Iran is to deny the United States military access, is to hold at risk U.S. assets, deny it military access that could be described as Posen's command of the global commons, right? Basically, American military impunity is the question when it comes to the relation between whether a state is a regional power or not, is a question of whether or not it can put up a fight with the United States. So the fact that the Iranians have been able to defeat the United States militarily, and by which I mean by something very specific, even if the United States were to renew the war and go back after it, it is much more likely that the United States will be disarmed by running out of its magazine rather than Iran will be disarmed. Now, that's a very, very new world because nobody anticipated this world. And in order to understand what that new world means, I'm insisting on describing Iran as a great power. But let me also go to your
point. I mean, again, there's a division here because I want to say where I agree. I do think Iran has shown itself to be a regional power able to deliver strategic defeat to the United States. That there's no disagreement there. And I also think this has crucial implications for things like Taiwan and the United States' ability to power project. So there's no disagreement there. Mm. What I find strange is the insistence on Iran being the fourth great power. That's absurd. I don't quite understand it. It seems ideological, but I don't know what ideology.
Pape's argument is different from my argument. Pape's insists that having gained control of the Hormuz weapon, the ability to shut off access to Hormuz, by itself gives Iran a leverage over other states. It can coerce the Europeans, it can coerce the Asians, Japanese, Koreans. Everybody has to make their way there. That's why the Norwegian head of state, the Norwegian leader had to go visit Iran during the ceasefire. That's why the Koreans had to visit Iran. Everybody has to be on good terms with the Iranians. And so the influence, Iran's influence goes very far and wide. And Pape thinks that this is a test of Iranian power as the fourth pole. And I don't disagree. But that is not the same thing as saying that Iran is a great power. When I say Iran's a great power, I mean that we have discovered what Iran already was, not that what Iran has become in the course of this campaign, in the course of this war. The reason is that, for me, this is one thing that they have weaponized. Being a big, strong power like Iran that is bigger than, in area, bigger than Germany and France and Italy and England combined, that has as many engineers as the United States, right? Being a big power with massive resources and great strategic depth means that you can take a hit, you can fight the United States in a way that other powers can't. You said that choke point control would make Singapore or Denmark a great power. Yes, if they can put up a fight with the United States and push it out of their region, I would consider them a great power, right? If they had beaten...
No, I would consider them a regional power because I think, again, this is a very strange and idiosyncratic definition of great power that has nothing to do with power projection beyond its region.
Even diplomats Denmark going to your... was going to be a great power.
Diplomats going to your country does not, to me, seem indicative of a great power. You would have to have some sort of ordering capacity.
Omar can fire at Hormuz ships. That's not the issue. The issue
Are the Houthis a great power?
Iran, huh?
Are the Houthis a great power?
The Houthis are a very interesting instance, but no, they are not a great power. And the reason why I would distinguish between Houthis and the Iranians is because the Houthis are, in first of all, dependent on a great power. Another one of Jack Levy's important ideas on this question is that it really matters that the
so is Iran with China and Russia
population be independent. Right?
Iran is not independent. Iran relies on China.
That's not true.
Yes, it is.
No, Iran has followed an independent great power policy and not relied on China for decades. And that is one of its problems. And
Iran barely has an air force because it needs China to build one. How could you have a great power and with precision air war? Is it just missiles? It's just, this is so many countries. Okay. I'm sorry. Go.
In terms of military technology, people are calling it the precision strike, precision mass regime, right? And this precision mass idea, who is the top leader in this? It's Iran, right? We copied the Shahed. The United States military has copied only one major weapon system in its entire history in 300 years, and that is the Shahed 136 drone, right? They're now selling like hotcakes. Some more than 50-100 countries are looking to acquire this sort of exquisite loitering munition that the Iranians have produced in these massive numbers and so cheaply. So Iran is a... I think people are underestimating just how much we have kind of been allowed our picture of the world to decay towards this sort of GDP picture that emerged in the 90s as an index of power potential and war making.
No, it's an index. I agree with you. It's not the only thing. And there's a tendency to overestimate it, but you're just totally ignoring it. You're saying it has no major influence, and Iran has a...
Okay, so let me put it this way.
Which to me is going, it's swinging the pendulum to the other side.
I don't think we should care what his GDP is. I think that at some point...
Sure. That's an argument.
Something else for me, and that is why I'm insisting really on it. But more importantly, I think that it's an analytical mistake that if you assume that Iran was not a great power, then you would do things like you do in your essay, which we should probably return to, which is that the Middle East is supposed to be a zone of influence for the United States. Well, the United States is the most important part of the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, is a denied region. The United States forces can't approach this damn place without getting shot, right? Like it's if there is a zone of a sphere of influence in the Persian Gulf region. If the Persian Gulf itself is a sphere of influence, it is a sphere of Iranian influence. And this then goes to our question about.
It's way too early to say that. It's been like 3 months. Also, just wanted as a historical matter, I don't think that's an accurate thing you said about weapon systems. Okay. I mean, there's like specific instances of like, I think the Springfield was based on the Mauser. But even beyond that, like the V2 program, that's the source of all U.S. missiles in the late 40s and beyond. So I just don't think that's an accurate claim as a military historian.
We didn't have an arsenal of V2s the way now we have an arsenal of Shahid.
But okay, so that's a criterion you're gesturing toward. But again, I just don't see what is treating it as a great power do as opposed to an important regional power analytically.
So it is so important because analytically, the issue is for me. The issue is forums, tables, behaviors of the states. If the states care a lot more about how the others think about a small set of states and can ignore and sort of bracket away or even like leave out of the picture altogether the other states, they are doing something. They are saying that in our discussions and calculation, we need to really think about how the U.S. is going to respond to what we're going to do here. If we decide today, we're having this discussion, this committee meeting or whatever, if the Americans or the Chinese are opposed to what we are doing, we need to think very carefully about it. If the Indians are, we don't particularly care about it, but what are the Indians going to do to us? Right. So the issue of shaping the perceptions and behaviors of the other powers is the great power system. If you're missing a power in the system and you pretend that it's not a great power, then you're going to make bad decisions and it's going to blow up in your face.
So Anasar, just to clarify, this is a prediction, and I guess time will tell, okay, that going forward, the major nations of the world are going to incorporate what Iran will think into their calculations. Yeah. That is the claim.
Strong claim. If the sanctions that the Europeans have on the Iranians, the European countries that are dependent on Gulf oil, if those sanctions stay in place and they are able to keep them and keep ignoring what Iran is asking for going forward, Iran is not a great power, right? It is the fact that they'll be forced to change their behavior out of fear that makes Iran a great power.
That will make Iran a great power. This is a prediction.
It's a prediction that the French will behave in certain way than the Germans.
Yes. Okay. That's a fair prediction. That's a falsifiable. That's good. Yeah. Okay. So I think this was very interesting. I think we've got what we're going to get out of this conversation. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to have you back in 6 months and then we could see where we go and where we go. But let's turn to the major point of the piece, which was, honestly, it was not the major point of the piece. Right. So it was funny to see you take such umbrage at it, but that's fair. This is why we write pieces. And I enjoyed this conversation and I knew you could take it. Mm-hmm. This is why I invited you on. But the major contention of the piece was, of course, this notion that the era of universalist ideology, which I argue has defined European, basically the Industrial Revolution forward. The way I think about it is that the major isms of the 19th and 20th centuries into the 21st, maybe if you count Islamism, which I'm not sure I would, but maybe you do, which is that these liberalism, communism, socialism, fascism were all effectively arguments about how to organize first an industrial and then a post-industrial political economy. And the major claim of the piece is that with capitalism having essentially colonized the entirety of the globe effectively, maybe you say North Korea isn't capitalist, or you could point to mixed capitalist economies, but I would argue when it comes to, you know, from a macro perspective, capitalism has quote unquote won. What I argue is that this notion of exporting universalist ideologies, which defined the 19th century with British and French liberal empire, you could even point to Austro-Hungary and Russia if you wanted. I think those were weaker cases, but I think the British and French empires were decidedly and consciously liberal. Obviously, the Cold War, a fight between capitalism and communism, however that's framed, broadly speaking, that's accurate. And then the unipolar moment with the United States effectively trying to export liberal, neoliberal capitalism all over the world. I argue that this is no longer the case and that the era of universalist ideological power projection is over and that we're going to retreat to a world defined by various spheres of influence. I do think the United States, at least as I see it, will continue to dominate the Middle East. So that does push back against the Iranian claim. I guess we shall see. These are two predictions. This is in flux. But effectively, with the U.S. controlling the Western Hemisphere, the Middle East, China controlling East Asia, Russia controlling its near abroad, the EU controlling Europe, India, South Asia, even though there's divisions there between China and et cetera. So a world of spheres of influence that lack ideological struggle. So Anasar, I've heard less of what you thought about that, but I will give you the opportunity now to push back, say I'm right, say I'm wrong. Please do.
I do think that this is an important intervention, Daniel. I would say that I don't see, and I'm being very, very critical here when I say this, I don't see why we need to stack on the ideological question on the question of the transformation of the international system. And if you want to argue that gives you a lot of mileage analytically, I would be happy to hear your argument. And I want to understand better actually how you think about this. What are we buying analytically when we say that there is an evacuation of ideology and that ideology in the 20th century sense does not exist anymore. But here's what I found really. Let me paint a small picture of where I think we are in a kind of very streamlined way, so that on top of this sort of streamlined skeletal picture, maybe you can tell me how adding ideology to this question gives us purchase. So the simple analytical picture I have is that of Gilpin, again, which is that you have
just to clarify, War and Change of World Politics,
yes.
Early 80s, Gilpin.
Yes.
Okay, the classic, the reading list book. Okay,
the reading list.
Neorealism. You're a neorealist.
Gilpin's not a neorealist.
I have my qualms with the. I mean, just very quickly, I wrote an article about this published in International Security. I think it's too systemic. I think it's too structural. I think it evacuates politics. I go deep into Waltz, less on Gilpin. I think we might mention Gilpin, though I don't remember. I don't think this is a particularly effective way to understand international relations. I think it's impacted by cybernetics. I think it's very much of its moment. Ironically, political scientists come to cybernetics 15 years after every other discipline, which says something about political science, perhaps.
Right.
But I don't think it's a useful way to understand international relations. But that's a larger... But I like Gilpin. I think he's smart. But I just want to say, like, if anyone wants to check this out, check out the article I co-wrote with Nicolas Guillot in International Security in 2015 on the basic problems with neo-realism or neo-structuralism, as
okay,
it's sometimes called.
As a, if you want to call me a fanboy, I would not say Gilpin, I would say Paul Schroeder, in terms of how I think about international politics. The reason why I say Gilpin is because the question here is change, and Gilpin kind of owns that piece, so to speak. Right? So Gilpin owns this lane. And this lane is like what happens to systems over time, what happens to systems of power that are highly concentrated at the end of these hegemonic wars.
But here's a question, Anushar, before we go on. Are international relations are not systems. That, to me, is a problematic metaphor borrowed from the social sciences due to various historical contingencies of the mid-20th century. I think orders is a better term because it's floatier and it's less restrictive. But IR is, like, for example, the very metaphor of a power vacuum is borrowed from physics, and that's just not how international relations work. If a power retreats, a power doesn't come into... So it's just like... Maybe you could defend the use of system because I just don't think historically
how they function. Let me do one better. So I'm not... Oh, okay, forget about Gilpin, forget about systems. I'm only saying that some people are paying a lot of attention to dynamics as opposed to static pictures of whatever the international world order, international order system, whatever. What is happening to them over time being the question? And here what we see happening, and this is what I was saying, I want to suggest a skinny picture, a skeletal picture. And that skeletal picture would be that you have this concentration of a unipolar system based on some whatever exogenous technology and distribution of capabilities and so on. And what happened too is that it became, there was dissipation in that system. And other powers became competitive with this unipole. And so the unipole's authority in the world transforms and begins to go away and erode. And so what you get is a regionalized world, right? So this process of regionalization through the diffusion of distribution of power in the system is the skeletal process. And I want to understand what you add by adding... the ideological decay, or not decay, but the very meta decay, if you were, as you would put it, maybe, but what happens where nobody believes in any deep ideology, right? So you have this regionalization occurring in that world where the great ideologies of the mid-century hyper-political world have completely vanished. Nobody buys them. So explain to me what you buy when you put this sort of very heavy frame on this skinny...
I mean, I think it provides opportunities for collaboration in ways that just weren't possible during the era of high ideology. So, for example, the United States would have never sent aid to East Germany. It relied on West Germany to do that when West Germany was becoming freer in the 70s and 80s and was able to pursue a policy of Ostpolitik. I ironically think that what the era of high ideology did, it tried to essentially leapfrog history. By not allowing for the creation of regional power blocks able to interact on a more equitable, even equal scale. And that also had to do with particular historical contingencies. I think China was uniquely weak during the era of high colonialism, for example. That is strange in the history of China going back thousands of years. So what I think it does, it allows you to focus on potential cooperation. It allows you to stop trying to do things like govern the world, which I do think was an ideological project. Why did the United States in the 1940s choose to dominate East Asia? That was at least partially, perhaps in that specific instance, maybe, no, it's never major, but it's never like 50%. It's never majority, not major. That was a partially an ideological project about pushing capital H history and capital P progress in a particular direction. So I think by recognizing that we're in a non-ideological or even a-ideological era, it could actually force our minds to focus more on interest and cooperation as opposed to, you know, believing that China joining the WTO is going to lead to political liberalization. So I actually do think it's crucial. Though I do think, and we probably agree, that the material transformation is most important. Ideology, in this instance, is partially a function of that material transformation.
I buy your argument that the absence of ideology in that sense, and I agree that the Cold War was an ideological project. I would subscribe to Anderson's, you know, Cold War degree zero picture of an ideological project. And therefore, in a sense, comparable, at least structurally for us. And I agree that what that buys you is spheres of influence, right? And so I think that it's very useful to think about spheres of influence because you can get very concrete very quickly, and which is very good because it keeps you honest, right? So this is why I think that the test that I propose of the Persian Gulf as a Iranian or American sphere of influence is a very good test of our pictures of the world, right? And I would suggest that we think about why in this Cold War project, of high Cold War containment policy and framework, foreign policy framework in the United States, why in that world Eastern Europe was a sphere of influence of the Soviet Union and why it was accepted at that. And I think that part of your intervention that I really, really liked was where you talk about how FDR accepted that picture of the world and Truman did not. And that this tells us about the transformation of US foreign policy that goes from something that would have opened the way to a multipolar world and a more regionalized world that was acceptable to the big powers, to something much more ideological and hegemonic, if you will, where, with the United States after Truman, and certainly after 1947, insisting on and imposing no more, not an inch more to the Russian sphere of influence. Whatever we have given them is fine, we signed it off at Yalta or whatever, but like we're not going to give you another inch from here. And I think that really comes together with the Berlin crisis in 48, where the United States puts its foot down and say, no more, you don't get any more sphere of influence. Whatever you got was too much already, right? And I think that this process, I want to understand how you think about this process working out, because now we just saw Trump almost essentially propose or accept the Chinese claim.
I think that's how it's going to work out, which is, I've been arguing that since 2022.
Right.
I mean, I wrote a cover story for Harper's that it's not a matter of if, but when
right.
the United States is going to retreat from East Asia. And what I really like about your argument, and this is, I think, correct, is that I think the biggest impact of the Iran war is that it really underlines the importance of drones. And it really underlines the inability of the United States to project power first against Iran. And you want to do that against China? Are you kidding me? Which has like such capacity. So I think that's totally right. So again, the question is, will the US foreign policy establishment accept that? I actually think it will. Mm. I used to be less skeptical of it, but if you look at the recent national security strategy, I mean, to me, that strategy does not read like especially bellicose toward China. I know some people have read it that way. Mm-hmm. I just don't read it. Like if you look at the major interests, it's like we compete with China. And so there's some stuff in there because obviously this is a document produced by committee representing different groups. But to my mind, the biggest takeaway is like, oh, there's a recognition we're already not hegemonic in East Asia and we're probably going to retreat far past the first island chain. right? This is going to go further and further back. So I think that is what, and I've been saying that's going to happen since 2022. Right. I said, and I thought that earlier, but like, obviously you're not going to be able to fight China. Are you kidding me? It's absurd.
So I did the math on that in a counter-based war model, building on the work of a number of people in the RAND Corporation. Models on base vulnerability. The picture is very ugly. If the United States goes to war against China tomorrow, it'll all the American bases will be essentially destroyed.
I agree 100% on this. And that to me is the biggest upshot of the Iran war. Not that Iran is a great power, but we'll come back to that.
I think that this implication is even more important than what's happening in the Gulf. And I think that this is forcing the United States to behave in certain ways, and that is going to lead to the emergence of a sphere of influence for China. I believe that I don't think we disagree on the Asian or the Western hemispheric spheres of influence of the United States and China. I think where we do disagree is what is happening in this middle zone that has been the most active zone of the world forever.
Right, and then the question is, I mean, you again,
can I? But I strongly disagree. I think that A, it can be proven that Iran, India is not a great power, and two, I think that, again, it's very important to realize that the EU is not a great power and that, in fact, Europe is becoming a playing field for the other powers, which is a kind of cognate concept we need to work with when we talk about spheres of influence, this concept of playing fields.
So, I mean, the way that I view it is maybe, I mean, this is like antiquity thinking, but I do think population matters and I do think nuclear weapons matter.
Okay.
And then India and obviously France have those.
Okay.
And so I don't think, and I think unlike you, this is might be a fundamental disagreement. I think the bracketing of the economy is going too far in the other direction. I do agree that you can't just measure power status according to GDP. What I like about it and what others like about it is it's like a relatively coherent measure, even though I think there's a lot of problems with GDP. It's much more difficult to measure power when you're talking about military. It gets floaty pretty quickly because it rests on counterfactuals and prediction. But it is obviously crucial, right? That military power is as crucial as economic power.
The test for the EU is very simple, in my understanding, the empirical test, which is whether they can whether they are dependent on the United States for the basic defense of Europe, right? And so if Russia can coerce them independently, if Russia can coerce Germany and then France and then Italy and then England, then the EU is not a unified security actor.
Well, and this is where you have to get historical, because I think it could coerce them on Estonia, not on Poland.
Sure.
Right? So then you're now we're at, as they call them political scientists, we're at the second image. We're like, Germany might be able to, like, we don't care about Latvia.
Right.
But if you fucking go into Poland, we're going to threaten you with nuclear use. I mean, like, not Germany, but like the EU.
Right.
And so I think that is when we get historical, and it'll be able to coerce on certain things and not on others. And that's where I get in.
There is a kind of, I have a Gray Anderson Zakaria picture of this. So I think that the problem of the EU is the problem that Zakaria identified in his PhD thesis with the American state in the late 19th century, which is
state-centered realism. So basically, Zakaria argues that what the second image is important, effectively. Zakaria, that state capacity.
Basically, the presidency was too weak for the United States to be a great power until the late 1890s. I'm sorry. And I think that something very similar is going on with the European Union today, where the sinews of power of the state are not built up enough, where the political unification has not gone far enough, that the European Union is a unitary security actor. Once that happens, yes, I agree that Europe is so economically vast and so talented and so skilled that there is no doubt in my mind that it'll be a pole in the system if it got its act together. My problem is that it is not getting its act together, and therefore it has been thought of as a playing field right now for the other party.
Which is a prediction on my behalf now, because I do think that the United States is going to leave. I do think you see moves, as I talked about in the piece, about this whatever Europe 2035 plan or whatever it's called, which remind me very much of these Chinese plans to modernize the military, which proved incredibly effective over a short amount of time, coming from a much lower base. So yes, that might prove wrong. If France and Germany, and who knows what happens with the UK going forward, maybe they rejoin some sort of mutual European defense community was proposed in the 60s. Yes, that is a prediction. I do think they'll be able to get their act together.
Okay, so then we are on different sides of the expectation here, because I find it very hard to see how the mutual suspicions and fears and politics and the sort of drive for sovereignty in the, especially between this complex that has emerged between Germany, Poland, and France is a tough nut to saw a crack. And it's not clear that they'll be able to get their act together. But as I said, if they do, then we'll certainly have a poll. But if they don't, what does this look like? And that is what I was trying to say, as that it will be a playing field for the other powers. And I think that that is a better picture for thinking about the Middle East in general. Not as an American sphere of influence, but as a playing field for many powers, as a model for what is emerging in the Middle East. But let me push back on the other claim of yours in terms of this polarity, right? India was going in that direction. You could see that in the big indicators and so on, that it was going to be a very, very large player in the system. What happens in the past couple of years is that the Chinese intimidate the Indians. That was the first signal in the Gadwan Valley confrontation and in the series of sort of skirmishes that the two have fought in these northern regions, Himalayan region. What has become clear is that China's position and stance is extremely coercive, and the Indians have out of fear accommodated Chinese superiority, and I think that gives you a very good signal for why, you know, the Chinese, for example, could assume away the Indian response function when they decide or when they're negotiating with the Americans. They don't really have to worry about what the Indians are doing behind the scenes the way they need to worry about what the Russians are doing and certainly what the United States is doing. And so that was one. The other was Operation Sindoor. With the downing of American fighter jets, that was a very high-intensity engagement, and the difficulty of defeating cleanly the Pakistanis. But more importantly, just the humiliation by the Pakistanis, the fact that the Indians could not immediately respond to that, I think really hurt Indian military prestige. And I think military prestige is, again, you know, you don't like Gilpin, I realize now, but I think military prestige is an extremely important currency, because when we talk about a world in which only straight power counts, right? So this non-ideological world is also like a unit-level development in the United States, where the United States says only power counts. Forget about all this crap, you know, all this woody-headed thinking about liberal and democracy and whatever not. But, you know, all that does not matter. What matters is power. You know, Stephen Miller declared our world to be a pure state power world. This is a very simple world, right? And in this simple world, if you don't have the balls to stand up to the bullies, then the bullies get to decide what's going to happen. And so in that sense, to me, like the confrontation in the Himalayas revealed that India was not ready to play in the big leagues. And among other things, it tells you that the United States cannot rely on India in a counterbalancing coalition, that the Quad's usefulness is not very pronounced if India is just not going to fight, right? So it's not. So what's the point of the Quad, right?
No, totally. I mean, then maybe I overrate nuclear weapons, which to me give one significant, potentially coercive or defensive power. But Anur, sorry, I think we're coming to the end here. Before we go, I'd love to have you back on again. Are there any final thoughts you want to leave our audience with? I mean, obviously subscribe to Policy Tensor, but besides that.
I think that one piece that I would like to talk to you more about, briefly if you can, is the role that 1914 is playing in your picture of why you don't regard our current multipolar world as similar to the imperialist post-escalation, post-1890 multipolar system of the European balance of power that culminated in 1914.
There was a hegemon in waiting.
I'm sorry?
There was a hegemon in waiting.
I mean, so we have a hegemon in waiting?
No, I don't think so. And that's a bigger story.
Because the world is going towards a near unipolar system where China is the unipolar.
No, I disagree. That's a different conversation, though. Maybe I should write an article against that. But that's just to answer the question. Mm-hmm. There was a hegemon in waiting. And I don't think there's a hegemon. I think there's a superpower that is kind of already a superpower. Mm-hmm. I don't think China has the same, for very particular reasons, partially ideological, desire to dominate the world in the way that the United States wanted to, due to a peculiar heritage of Protestant millenarianism, and was able to due to the developed world committing suicide in World War II. That is what I would say would be very different. And I think China does not have a genuinely global desire. I think you see that through the Belt and Road Initiative. I wrote about this in the piece. And I don't think it has the capacity to, for example, become hegemonic in the Western Hemisphere, like the United States was for decades.
So I give you that you know, the rise of the United States is structuring that world in such a dramatic way that it's not that, you know, this idea that it's just a multipolar system that's very, very low standards when it comes to European standards of statecraft and norms about state behavior, that this world is not exactly comparable for that reason, perhaps. But let me point out one useful reason why this is comparable. And I think that it's what is happening is not just the evacuation of ideology. What is happening is not just the rise of a dog-eat-dog world. But I think we need to think more about what the dog-eat-dog world actually looks like, right? How does it work? And to me, this the Israeli policies of the past few years, since October 7th especially, have really underlined how the analogy that we need to reach for is Schroeder's card game analogy, right? So what Schroeder is saying is that between Napoleon and Bismarck's dismissal, between Waterloo and Bismarck's dismissal, you have a world that is closer to the great powers playing poker, where each player is supposed to stay in the game, and that you're playing for limited risks. And trying to get an advantage on the other guy. But there is a basic assumption about who gets to play and stay in the game. And moving from that from poker to Monopoly, where you are now eliminating your rivals, you are bringing the norms that were more appropriate for the colonial realm back to the European continent. And in this, once you start playing poker, then things escalate. And things get very dangerous. So that is his model for how Austria-Hungary gets cornered by the Entente, and this, you know, this is what he calls a bomb placed in southeastern Europe, right? And I think that this is a very good way of thinking about a world, a straight power world, because it's not just a straight power world. It's a straight power world in which there are states trying to murder other states. And I think that creates a radicalization of international system, and the international order gets much more unstable when you have a state like Serbia, for example, in it, or Israel in it. And I think that that's a purely straight power, purely realist world is not just that it's not fun and games, as you said, but that there may be more dynamic radicalizing elements under, keeping it, which might lead to catastrophe, very big catastrophes.
Yeah, I think, and then we've got to end here, but I think that now we're getting into difference between within sphere governance and between sphere governance, which is important. So I talk about that a little, gesture toward it in the piece, because I do think ideology will operate within spheres. I think it is going to be less operative between right. And then there are these quote unquote like spoiler states that are just so chaotic and so anti-normative that they could threaten to basically put what you're gesturing toward a Franz Ferdinand, and then you'd be able to sort of see an outbreak of major war, even though I do think that nuclear weapons does transform that structure. But that is for a different conversation. Anusar, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Everyone, check out Policy Tensor, follow him on Twitter, check out the Substack, and I'd love to have you back again soon to do some more risk talk. Thank you so much, Anusar.
Thank you for having me, Daniel.